Morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto, and I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I am calling this meeting of the committee to order. This meeting is being called pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this kind. And I want to direct the attention of members of the public to our committee website, where you'll find quite a lot of material related to this meeting, including our meeting agenda and the documents we'll be talking about as well. So with that, let's go with the call of the roll. Ms. Chambers, please do that.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson. Representative Bennett. Representative
Senator Bennett is having some technical issues. She said that she's trying to connect now.
Yeah.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels. Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Juergens, present.
Representative Cotiza-Watoon.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Wasliwick.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
Awesome. We have a quorum.
Thank you. And I will note, I don't know if we could hear Representative Franson, but I know that she is here. And as was noted, Representative Bennett was trying to get in as well. So I think we have pretty much everybody. So thank you so much, members. And so we do have a set of minutes for review. And Representative Pryor, if you could please move approval of the minutes for our February 16th meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move the minutes from the February 16th meeting.
Thank you. Any additions or corrections, members, to those minutes? And hearing nothing, all in favor of approval of our minutes from February 16th, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, that motion passes, and the minutes from February 16th are approved. So, members, we have a action-packed day. First, we're going to be hearing a proposal for a new state agency. So we're going to have Representative Pryor take over as chair, and we'll go from there. Oops. If she can get unmuted.
Moment. Thank you. Now I am unmuted. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Our next item on the agenda is House File 1024. Chair Pinto, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 1024 be referred to the Education Finance Committee.
So moved. Chair Pinto, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So members, we have spent the last month hearing a series of presentations kind of laying the foundation for our work in this committee. And in those presentations, we've seen how critical the earliest years are. And I hope the members will agree at this point that there's really nothing more important that we do as a society than get those earliest years right. Once we do that, that's the foundation for everything else that follows. We've also heard about then a series of programs that state government oversees that are intended to support that process. And we've heard about those programs being in a wide variety of places throughout agencies. I've been studying this for a number of years, and I will admit that even I have been dizzied a little bit by just the sheer variety and the locations of programs all over. And so what the proposal in front of you today is to have a department that is dedicated to this extremely important societal goal and making sure that our state is supporting families in their work to make sure that the children get off to that that terrific start and are ready for kindergarten and ready to go. Something that really right now we don't have someone in state government who is responsible and accountable and has the authority for that really below the level of the governor and lieutenant governor. So first, members, we're going to be hearing from a couple of national experts talking about how this is working in other states and a distinct trend towards this and talking about the proposal and then get into some of the details. So my first testifier then is from the National Conference of State Legislatures, Allison May, if she can speak with us, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Welcome to the committee, Ms. May. Would you please state your name again for the record and proceed with your testimony and presentation?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Pinto. Good morning, committee members. My name is Allison May, and I'm an early care and education policy associate at the National Conference of State Legislatures, or NCSL for short. During my few minutes with you, I'd like to share a bit about what NCSL does, then focus in on my work related to early childhood, including tracking early childhood governance action, and then just share some highlights and overviews of some of the legislative activity we've been seeing. I'll be happy to answer your questions. If I'm unable to provide an answer today, I could do the necessary research and connect early next week. So the National Conference of State Legislatures is the country's most trusted bipartisan organization, serving legislators and staff for more than 40 years. We promote policy innovation, create opportunities for lawmakers to share knowledge, and ensure that state legislatures have a strong and cohesive voice at the federal level. NCSL is the only organization that serves all 7,383 legislators and the some 25,000 legislative staff. And notably, we track more than 1,400 different policy areas. So some really big and broad things, some very narrow focused topics as well. And in a typical year, we host more than 100 policy-oriented meetings. So my work in the Early Care and Education Project falls within our Children and Families or Human Services program. And my focus is policy that's related from the prenatal period through pre-kindergarten. So one of our big things we do is track legislation and a whole host of early childhood issue areas ranging from pre-kindergarten, childcare, home visiting, and early childhood governance. All that information is available on the web, including links to the bill text. And then annually, we summarize and produce a report of major enactments. 2020 will be out in about a week. Our writing comes in the forms of policy briefs, reports, web pages on a whole host of topics, and these are a few of the more recent. And then related to convenings, we host them with frequency, and for the legislators and staff on the line, I'd invite you to register for the State Policy 101. We're hosting every Friday in February. Tomorrow, I'm going to be exploring paid leave, and then next week, we're talking about early childhood more broadly. So as we drill down and start to think about early childhood governances, there are really three primary approaches that states look at: create, consolidate, collaborate, and coordinate. So let me share a few examples to better explain that. So in the first approach, creating a dedicated early childhood agency, and there are six states that have done this. We can look to Alabama, Washington, and then Chair Pinto's House File 1024. So the Alabama Department of Early Childhood Education was created as an executive department of state government, replacing the Department of Children's Affairs. The reason to effectively oversee programs and to support children in Alabama. The program or the department has four offices that guide the state's early childhood priorities. And then we can look to Washington State. And in 2017, the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, a cabinet-level department, was created to focus on the well-being of children. And the real goal was to help produce better outcomes for Washington communities. Other states that have gone in this direction include Connecticut, Georgia, Massachusetts, and New Mexico. As we move to the next item, consolidate, there are 12 states and the District of Columbia that have consolidated several agencies or programs into one entity that oversees multiple components. An example we can look to is Maryland. And in 2005, all early childhood programs were moved to the newly created Division of Early Childhood, which is housed within the Maryland Department of Education. And finally, 32 states have various different agencies that provide programs and services that require coordination between the agencies. A quick example would be the Pennsylvania Office of Child Development and Early Learning. This is overseen jointly by Departments of Human Services and Education and was created in 2006. And then a second and more recent example is Delaware, where they consolidated the Office of Child Care Licensing into the Office of Early Learning within the Department of Education. I think worth noting is whichever direction states go, the main goal should really be better outcomes for children and better communication throughout the areas of the state that touch the lives in some form or fashion of children and families. So as we start to look a little more specifically at legislative action, I want to mention that when I am saying early childhood governance, I'm talking about legislative action NCSL has flagged in our database, and it includes legislation relating to advisory councils and boards, study committees, and systems. So this is a bit broader than Chair Pinto's new Bill 1024. Of course, legislative activity to establish a department would be included in this area. An additional note, we do find often that legislation might fit in more than one location. So a bill might be tagged in governance, but also childcare or pre-kindergarten as an example. I don't want to say much about the stats on here. I do want to point out two examples from 2019. So in 2019, Maine introduced Senate Bill 513, which, if enacted, would have created the Department of Early Care and Learning. They did, however, have some other legislative activity that was enacted that year. The other big story from 2019 was Senate Bill 22 in the land of enchantment or New Mexico. This bill created and established the Early Childhood Education and Care Department, which officially launched this past summer. The legislation created a transfer of early childhood related functions of other state agencies to the department. Excuse me. And through, though 2020 was a unique year, we continue to see legislators grapple with infrastructure and the administration of programs that serve young children and their families. So this map shows the action that we tracked last year. There were a total of 49 bills from 18 different states on this topic. And then there were 6 states that passed a total of 10 bills altering the governance of early childhood programs. Likely your eyes are noticing that the states highlighted really do represent both red states, blue states, and purple states. I will just pick out one thing. Arguably in 2020, the Virginia legislature made the most sweeping changes with the creation of a new office of the Children's Ombudsman and mandate for a unified early child care education system. And as we take a look at 2021, almost all states are back in session now. A few have already begun introducing governance-related legislation. I can share anecdotally that a handful of states, both more conservative and more liberal, are currently discussing early childhood governance issues. Session's fairly early on in many states, though. I haven't spotted legislation to create an own department similar to Representative Pinto's. But there are a handful of states that are introducing and enacting, and then in Missouri, we have an executive order to consolidate some programs. And then a final few thoughts that I do want to share with you all. We do know that early childhood receives very strong support from Republicans, independents, and Democrats alike. We also know that both red, blue, and purple states are currently engaging in conversations around early childhood governance. So the current introduced legislation here in Minnesota aligns with how other states have worked to tackle and amend their governance system. So creating new departments has been shown to be effective in other states. And if enacted, having the appropriate timeline to implement, along with all the key stakeholders as part of the conversation, will certainly be key to your success. I've noted just 3 external resources, including Elliot's report, who we'll hear more from momentarily. I'll flag that the first and last bullet points there also include state profiles, so you can really dig into Minnesota-specific along with neighboring states, which is sometimes interesting. So in closing, happy to take any of your questions. Thank you for the opportunity, and legislators, please remember NCSL is here to support you, so do feel free to call on us.
All right, that's what happens when you have multiple screens up. Thank you, committee, for pointing that out for me. I appreciate that help. And thank you, Ms. May, for your presentation. I trust you'll be able to stay with us through the end of our presentations and our bill presentation, and we will be taking member questions at that point. Chair Pinto, would you like to call on your second presenter? And you're on mute, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members that Ms. May referenced Elliot Regenstein and the report that he had that was in one of the links on that last slide. And so we're going to hear from him next.
Thank you, Representative Pinto, Vice Chair Pryor, and members of the committee. I'm Elliot Regenstein from Foresight Law and Policy. And many thanks to Polly for sharing the slides. So the reason I'm here today is that last year I had the opportunity to work on a report that's called Early Childhood Governance, Getting There From Here. And for that report, interviewed national and state leaders from across the country, including more than half of the states, about early childhood governance. So talked to a wide range of states across the political spectrum, some states that have made major governance changes, others that have not. And from that conversation distilled a set of lessons. And I'm gonna start with a very high level overview right now, but we'll be available to answer questions when we get to that point in the program. So on the next slide, it talks about some of the key concepts to have in mind in thinking about governance. Governance is all about trade-offs, right? There's no perfect system. And so the question is Minnesota's governance system set up to achieve its substantive goals? In early childhood, you've had the opportunity through preschool development grants in particular to develop a strategic plan and talk about what your state goals are. And so now the question is what is the governance structure that will most effectively help you achieve that? In thinking about that, the trade-offs that other states have made can be instructive. Their experience is probably informative, but your knowledge of the Minnesota context is going to be the most important thing. And so again, I present lessons from other states with the knowledge that while that can be useful to predict what might happen in Minnesota, it's not necessarily the case. It's also important to emphasize that to make a transition from the current state to any future state, as this bill proposes, comes at some cost, but there is also a cost to not acting, right? And what a lot of states have thought about is the idea that they're spending tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars on early childhood, and that to spend all of that money in through an organization that is not or optimized to really manage that system mean, you know, they find inefficient, and they'd rather pay the cost of doing the work up front so that they can then run the sort of larger annual expenditure in a more effective way. So on the next slide, you know, and this sort of builds on the point I was just making. Early childhood is a very fragmented system. You have childcare, you have Head Start, you have preschool, you have home visiting. And as long as each individual program is being run by program administrators, who again, in many instances are doing the absolute best they can with the mandate they've been given, you know, there is a big difference between trying to coordinate among programs and having a single commissioner level leader who is responsible for making sure that those programs work together, right? Because the interactions among those programs are dynamic and take place in a complicated market. So having an agency that can build that expertise and take that leadership, right? In some states, the idea of having a commissioner level leader who can speak for the system, who is accountable to stakeholders in the system, has been a critical part of the conversation. So that role is one that's not currently being played in most states. And in some ways, again, the states that have made changes have done so not necessarily because they were dissatisfied with the jobs that their current staff were doing, but because they realized that even if the staff in the current jobs were doing everything they could, there were still roles in managing the system that no one was playing, and that the creation of a new structure would allow those roles to be played. In thinking about how they go about that, states have had somewhat different emphases on what is most important to them. A few of the priorities that have driven states in governance changes have included minimizing the burden on families, right? Right now, when the system is disorganized, families are the ones who bear the burden of navigating it. Can a single state agency play a stronger role in helping those families? I've talked about improving efficiency, and obviously states are also looking at how do we expand access to services and how do we ensure quality, where part of that conversation is having a consistent definition of quality across multiple programs, or at least harmonized definitions, even if they're not exactly the same. So on the next slide, just a couple of important considerations for states as they, you know, and for you in particular, based on the experience of other states. So the idea of comparative advantage is really important, and that there are certain functions within an early childhood system that in effect have to be played by state government. But there are other functions that are probably better off being played at a regional or local level, and that a change in governance is an opportunity to think about what those are and what functions you might want to put at a state agency, at a regional hub, or at the community level. And in this bill, there is attention to that, or at least the notion of regional hubs that would then have to be developed. It's important to think about state personnel capacity, right, at multiple levels. As I mentioned, one of the things states have looked for is creating a commissioner level leader on this topic, but you also need to have strong managers and then adequate staff to get the job done. That's true in any configuration. When configuring state capacity, you need to think about connective tissue across agencies and about analytic capacity. In Minnesota, there's a children's cabinet and a state advisory council. A change like this does not make the need for those bodies go away. It might change their role somewhat, but there's no scenario in which an early childhood agency is running everything in education and health to the point that it doesn't need to collaborate. So those collaborative bodies remain important. And a transition period. States that have made this change, there is a balance to be struck between keeping the work moving and having a sense of urgency about it, right? You don't want a 10-year timeline because then nothing happens, but you also don't want to try to do this in a few months because there are a lot of moving parts that need to be managed. I will say that the states that have gone through it have been very generous with their time, and that New Mexico in particular has shared a lot of its materials with other states that are thinking about going through it, and have talked about some of the lessons they learned in their very recent transition. So again, I can get into some of those if people are interested, but that that there is a community that looks out for states on this. So a couple of final thoughts. The framework of this bill is very similar to what other states have done. Again, it includes attention to regional capacity and a transitional period. Really important to emphasize that how the transitional period gets used is critical, and that in a transitional period, there is a need both for the folks within state government affected by the transition to have a little bit of protected space, right? Like they are gonna need an opportunity to communicate with each other on their own outside the eyes of larger stakeholders, because there are some things that are very sensitive that they're gonna need to work on. But it's also incredibly important to have public involvement and accountability in the larger process, continued legislative oversight, lots of stakeholder engagement, appropriate advisory groups, and an inclusive transition process is key to the success, because that's what engages all the people who are going to end up being the partners of this agency, and that their views on how it should be shaped are really important. I will say that that sounds like a lot of work, and it probably is, but that every state I had talked to that went through the transition ended up feeling like it was worth it. And that was true, again, across the political spectrum, across the nature of transitions, right? Different states ended up with different models. Washington's actually an interesting case because they created a Department of Early Learning more than a decade ago, felt like they kind of botched the landing, right? That they had done a pretty bad job of getting it set up. But eventually the agency found its land legs, and then when they created the Department of Children, Youth and Families, they were building on that platform from years earlier. And that's an important idea too, is that this is not sort of, we're gonna pass a bill now and then check back in 15 years to see how it went. It's, if you pass a bill, how do you think of that as the jumping off point for continued conversation and a body of ongoing work that, again, will require the legislature and other stakeholders to remain engaged? So I've said a lot. That is all I will say at the outset, but really glad to have this opportunity and happy to answer any questions people have when we get into discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Rentenstein. At this point, members, if you have questions for Chair Pinto or for our testifiers, please raise your hand and we'll call on you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I just a few other remarks to lead into those questions, if that's okay. I just want to make sure the members are aware that our state has actually been studying this for coming up on 10 years now. There was a 2011 report from a legislatively mandated task force that called for the creation of a dedicated agency. The call at that point was for an office, supposed to be the equivalent of the Office of Higher Education, but it would similarly combine programs into one dedicated separate state agency. So we've been studying this for a number of years, and there was very strong support in that proposal for this. And I want to note the letters of support that are on our committee website and urge members of the public and members of the committee, of course, to take a look at them. They include a link to that 2011 task force report. I want to make sure that, that members are just aware briefly of the content of the bill, because it is pretty simple. There's the summary, two-page summary on the committee website, which indicates that what the proposal is to pull programs from relating to home visiting from the Department of Health, relating to early care and learning from Departments of Human Services and Department of Education. Those programs are listed. And per the point of Mr. Regenstein, we're really talking about a fairly lengthy implementation timeline to make sure that this work is done in the right way and make sure that our agency does stick the landing. I know Washington State has been thrilled with their own agency dedicated to this, but it took a little while for that to settle because of possibly rushing that situation. So this would take effect the upcoming gubernatorial term, so 2 years from now, to make sure there's a nice 2-year lead time. And then I want to confirm a couple of other things. This would not add any new programs. We're talking about taking the existing programs, putting this in this department. But if you think about the three options that were laid out by Ms. May of coordinating programs, consolidating inside of one of the existing agencies, or having a new agency, it seems that there's a real advantage rather than, if you think about some of the disadvantages explained in coordinating among different places, that has some real challenges. You could imagine putting them, combining programs into one of our existing departments, but putting all the programs in the Department of Human Services or all the Department of Education. There are some challenges there we can talk about if folks are interested. To my mind, having an agency with a dedicated authority, as was described, is a huge advantage. And with that, I think we probably are ready for questions. And Madam Chair, thank you so much.
Well, I will start with question. One question that I have is, and I think I'll direct this to the bill author, Chair Pinto. Could you talk about any concrete kind of like measurements that we've seen between a state like Washington that's gone down this path, where they're saying, yes, you know, these are our measures of success now that we feel like we've gotten our act together and it's working. Could you address some of those benefits that they're seeing right now, or other states that are seeing right now? Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I might actually direct the national question to perhaps Mr. Regenstein, and just want to note for members, I'm so glad you brought this up, Madam Chair, the programmatic metrics that are contained in the bill. And if you look on page 5 of the bill, there are a series of very concrete program objectives and program measures that are laid out. And then a report that the commissioner would need to make to us, to our committees in the legislature, reporting about exactly how the department is, quote, effectively coordinating and creating efficiencies among programs as well as funding streams, and precisely how those program measures are being accomplished. So we have a lot of that in this proposal in Minnesota, but as far as how it's working in other states, I guess I'll defer to somebody else on that.
Yeah, and I'm happy to jump in. And I think it's a great question because it's something that states have to some degree struggled with. And it sort of, even within states that have done it, depends on who you talk to, right? Like there are some advocates who say their only metric is, are more kids getting served, right? But that's ultimately a legislative function primarily, you know, relating to budget. So, you know, they're thinking of it in terms of having a commissioner who can make the case for that. When you think of how states have approached it though, I think that the metrics they've used are probably in many ways similar to what your Representative Pinto is talking about, that you can look at, are we managing things more efficiently? Are we making it easier for parents, right? In some ways, it's hard to have standardized metrics, but it is something that if you set yourself to certain tasks, you could, and I would recommend this as part of it, you know, commission an independent evaluation of, did we do what we said we were going to do? Because a lot of this comes down to operational efficiency, it's not always, you know, and operational efficiency, not just in the sense of, is the agency itself running efficiently, but are we managing the entire pot of tens of millions of dollars more efficiently? You know, I think it's worth having a conversation at the beginning about what your metrics of success are going to be, and then holding yourselves to account on that, but that there's not some standard set of metrics of success that all the states have used.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and Mr. Regenstein. Next, we'll go to Representative Bennett for your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me one second here. I have a noisy cat probably going to interrupt us. I'm contemplating all the things I've heard, and I agree with the concept of the better coordination, better governance, and hopefully, you know, better service for people, you know, government serving people. But I do have concerns for the future. Especially when government starts doing things like this, and they're always good ideas, quite often they tend to grow and grow and grow and turn into these monstrous things all on their own. And I am concerned about that. I'm also concerned about the cost of the transfer and doing this right now being when we're facing a deficit. I want to make sure that we're putting as much funding we can into programming and not into government. So I'm questioning if this is the right time to do this because of our deficit situation. But I do have a couple of questions. So one, I'm wondering if Mr. Chair, author of the bill, if this should be more of a phased approach, and your opinion on that, because we're kind of trusting Chapter 15 right now to make sure this is handled smoothly and so on, and transferring cleanly from these three agencies. And what happens, for example, if federal entanglements, you know, we don't get the authorization and so on that we need for various programs? And just wondering if a phased approach might be better. And also if you could comment on the cost of the transfer, and because that's a concern to me as well, just right now.
Thank you, Ms. Bennett. I will direct that then to Chair Pinto, the bill author.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bennett, for the two great questions. So first of all, regarding the phased approach, I guess it feels like in a way that it is set up that way, in that it would not take effect for a full 2 years from this summer, so I suppose 2.5 years from now. And so that really does give the chance to make sure that things are both coming together right, and I suppose it means that if things are really looking like they're going to go in a really bad direction, it gives the chance for, you know, there'll be several legislative sessions leading up to that point to say, boy, we need to take a different direction. We know that, you know, regarding federal entanglement, we know that with multiple states having done this, I don't expect, we have models of this having been done. So I think we can be pretty confident that there's not some major landmine that tells us that this is just, you know, just completely can't be done. But if there are tweaks that are necessary, the nice thing is that we have a couple years leading up to it. And it seems like that was the national expertise that was shared with me in putting this together, was to make sure to have that period of time. So in a way, I guess it is a phased approach, so to speak, in that way to really lead up to it. And then regarding the cost, there's a cost for the transition. I believe in Washington State, I think it was $1 million. And of course, you know, we know right at the moment with the forecast we have, and certainly at all times, we want to make sure we're really being smart with the money that we're spending. I will note, though, this, just like this area of early childhood, this really is investment in the long term and in the future. We are spending a lot of money in this area, and we are spending that money in a pretty fragmented way. And we have amazing professionals, as we heard on Tuesday, doing work to coordinate it, the Children's Cabinet Preschool Development Grant. But in the long run, it seems to me anyway, that ends up meaning the money we're spending is being spent in a lot more effective and efficient way if you've got the accountability and authority that comes from having an organization driving it. So that'd be my thought on that second question as well.
And you have a follow-up, Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, excuse me, I do appreciate those thoughts, Mr. Chair, and I'll think about this more. I am, you know, the cost of it, $1 million, I think is a good investment potentially in the future. I do have qualms about spending that right now. And we'll see what the February forecast shows, but I guess I'd much rather see in a time where we may end up having to cut things, probably will have to cut certain things. I'd rather see that $1 million put into early childhood scholarships to expand the number of children we can do and kind of put this on the shelf for a few years into the future. But I will definitely think about that and consider more as I listen to the discussion. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any further comments, Mr. Chair?
No, I guess maybe I will just note, this feels as timely as anything, just to say that I would expect that if this proposal does end up moving forward in our process, I would expect it to do so through this committee's budget proposal, if that's the case. And so I do expect, you know, this proposal has to move through a number of committees. It's one reason that we want to make sure to be moving it on and continuing that discussion. But Representative Bennett and everybody else, it will have to come back through our committee as we put together our budget proposal. And at that point, we'll get another opportunity to look at it, look at the cost, and make that assessment then as well. So that may be reassuring for today. It's sort of, this is, in a way, we're kind of more looking at it from a policy perspective today. And that final decision about the spending part of it, if at all, would come at a later date. And I hope that maybe is reassuring to Representative Bennett as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And next we'll go to Representative Juergens for your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Pinto, this is it's a bold undertaking. You and I have talked about it, and I appreciate the goals to make these programs more efficient, perhaps reduce or eliminate duplication of efforts. I do have concerns. I know that the goal is that there would be, that this isn't a growing government, that it would be a transfer of resources, transfer of employees, transfer of programs. And government, unfortunately, doesn't do real well with that. And so one of my concerns is that even though the desire and the goal is that this would not grow government, that it would, that as employees leave one department, there isn't a net zero gain, that there would be an increase. So that's one of my concerns. I would like to hear from the three departments and how this would affect them and how they could see this transition taking place. So there's a lot of things that I don't think we're quite ready for. I do understand the need to hit different committees in the process. So I think Representative Bennett had some concerns that she brought up that I don't need to reiterate, but some of the same concerns that I had there. But I think the goal is good. I think the goal to have better accountability for these programs that are gonna help the youngest Minnesotans, I think that's good. And I appreciate the conversation. I think though that we have a ways to go before we're ready to actually move forward with this, but I'm glad that you're bringing it up and we're having the conversation. I look forward to the further conversations and also after it hits the other committees and having this come back to us, maybe in a slightly different form or even the same form with just more questions answered. So I'll be looking forward to that. And I just wanna thank you for bringing this up and hope that we can come to something where we can definitely get bipartisan support behind this.
Thank you, Representative Juergens. Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so much, Representative Juergens. And maybe it's helpful so as the bill goes to those other committees, I think that'll be a particular opportunity in those committees to be hearing from the individual departments. I know that the plan is to send it, my motion is to send it to Education Finance. And so being Chair Dabney's committee, expect to hear thoughts from that perspective there, and then the Health Committee, Human Services, et cetera. And then again, to have it come back and sort of yet another opportunity then to get that perspective. And so, I absolutely want to be hearing from all directions. And so I just really appreciate your point, Representative Juergens. And hopefully that lays out for folks as well, kind of the anticipated path here. So thank you.
Right. Now I see another question. Representative Wadsworth, your question or comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, just a comment. I'm really glad to see this proposal come forward. I think as we've seen from the one presentation we had where they're talking about all of the funding streams and all of the different people and departments and things that are involved in this, it's really complicated for people to understand. And I think it makes it more complicated for families trying to access these programs and services. So I'm glad to see the proposal come forward. You know, I think folks do have some concerns, but I think that it's a good start to the conversation about how we make sure that those programs and resources for our families and our youngest Minnesotans are sort of more accessible and easier to access and also sort of streamlined in a way that we can hopefully get more folks who are looking for those supports in those programs on board with them, so that we're not sort of struggling to figure out how to put everything together. So appreciate the work that's been done on this, Representative Pinto, and look forward to it moving forward.
Thank you,
Representative Wasilek. That's excellent thoughts. And I will build on that idea, is that especially people that are new members of this committee, you probably have felt like there's a steep learning curve because we hear not just from one department, but we hear from multiple departments that all have a significant role to play in this area of early childhood learning. And it's a lot of information, because it's fragmented information. And instead of pulling together as one source to say, you know, this is how we address this, this is how we're doing this, it's everybody's trying to do a little bit of everything in many ways. So I know when I started three terms ago, this was an issue then, and it's been an issue every term since then. So I'm appreciative of Chair Pinto's bill that is actually working to bring some resolution and some clarity and some comprehensiveness to this incredibly important work that we're doing. And I see now we also have a question from Representative Katiba Lutun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not a question, but just a quick comment. I wanted to say thank you to Chair Pinto for all the work that he's done in this area. And today, I think, you know, when we had the opportunity to hear from NCSL and Ms. May speaking about the different states and different actions that have been taken across the country to kind of move forward. I think, you know, we on this committee, after all the informational hearings that we've had thus far and over the past sessions, we really know that early investments in this part of life can make a dramatic difference, the return on investment. So when we invest in our children, that's going to come back to the state however many times fold, upwards of 10, 18 fold is some of the research that we've seen. But I think that, you know, when we have to consider taking a look and putting in some potential funding upfront to make this system better, that's also going to come back to us in the long run. So I appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion and really consider how this may take us forward to a stronger program and just really centralize so many of the important pieces of early childhood here in Minnesota. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watun. And I will turn it to the author of the bill, Chair Pinto, for the final word.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for the good discussion. I want to make sure to emphasize that this proposal is in no way a criticism of the current people doing this work in the administration. In fact, I really can't think of three more qualified commissioners of these departments than Commissioner Sharpstead, Malcolm, and Ricker. I mean, just extraordinary people. And their teams are terrific. And I can't really think of anybody with more vision and dedication than Erin Bailey and her team in the Children's Cabinet, which we heard from on Tuesday. So folks are doing incredible work with the structure that we have right now. But I think the lesson from around the country is that structure has, just the structure itself has some real challenges and some major disadvantages, and that there are significant advantages, as one would expect, when you have responsibility and accountability and authority in one person and in one organization to get this critical area right. There's nothing that's more important than getting that right. And so this is the trend in the states. This is where Minnesota should be going, in my view. And I really appreciate members' support to move this on to other committees, continue this conversation, and bring it back before our committee in a few weeks as we're considering our budget at that point. But in the meantime, to keep this conversation going. Thank you so much, Madam Chair, again, and to our national presenters. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Chair Pinto. And yes, thank you again to our presenters for the great information that you brought into the committee this morning. So at this point, Chair Pinto renews his motion that House File 1024 be referred to the Education Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll on this motion.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Aye.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Aye.
Representative Franson.
Yes.
Representative Bennett.
No.
Representative Bolden.
Aye.
Representative Daniels.
No.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Damon.
Aye.
Representative Juergens.
Aye.
Representative Cotiza-Witun.
Aye.
Representative Morrison.
Aye.
Representative Wazlowick.
Aye.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, aye.
Branson, no.
We have four nays and nine yeses.
There being nine ayes and four nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1024 is referred to the Education Finance Committee. I will now hand the gavel back to Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. And so with that, we're going to turn to our next bill, which is House File 910. This bill, the plan is to lay this over for possible inclusion in a budget bill. And Representative Cotiza-Witun, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 910 to be before the committee and to be laid over for potential inclusion in the future omnibus bill.
Thank you for that motion, Representative Cotiza-Witun. I understand that you have an A1 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do have the A1 amendment, author's amendment, just to get the bill in the shape that I would like.
Okay. And we have a motion to make the bill in the form that Representative Cotiza-Witun would like. Any questions about that motion? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails, and Representative Cotiza-Witun, the bill is in the form that you wish, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 910 is a... It requires a report on early childhood education and care, ECE programming, participation of young children from the ages of 0 to 5 in foster care, and a plan to increase their participation in these programs. So we just are looking to collect some data by race, ethnicity, age, county of participation. We're looking for the DHS to identify any additional resources that would be necessary to collect and report that information going forward. We are hopeful that the plan will increase participation to be developed in collaboration with affected families, counties, schools, communities and ECE providers and others. So that interim progress report would be due this next January in 2022, and the final report next June. So really, the idea behind this is that young children, especially infants and toddlers, are more likely than any other age children to be removed from their home and placed in out-of-home placement or foster care. And disproportionately, they are children of color. So when we talk about racial equity and then really consider that lens going forward, we know, again, here in this committee, especially after all the presentations that we've seen thus far, that the disparities truly begin prenatally, but then they are exacerbated in those first few years of life. So failure to support these children and their foster families and their biological families increases the chance that these children will not be ready for kindergarten. So requiring special education services as they go through the K-12 system and or those children not reaching their full potential once they are in school. So research indicates, as we know, that early care and education programs work. They reduce that need for special education in the future with improved cognitive and language skills and reductions in problem behaviors. So there's very little known actually about how many Minnesota foster children currently are participating in ECE programming across the state, but the few data points that are available indicate low rates, even though they are a high priority group. So we want to just gather this information, pull it together and link it in the system through kind of like MDE's early childhood longitudinal data system, and it can be incorporated into the annual out-of-home care and permanency report that's currently required by the legislature. So I am a former foster parent in Hennepin County, and I think that in my personal experience, anecdotally, my children were able to benefit from some SE programming as well as ECE programming before they came to us here in Eden Prairie. And I'm so grateful for the expertise and the programs that were available to get them those early interventions. And I know that sometimes it's overwhelming to, you know, to be a parent in general, but to be a foster parent and to maybe not be familiar with all the systems. If you are welcoming a child into your home of a younger age that you maybe haven't cared for previously in the past. And so we really want to make sure that to support foster parents and make sure that they have all the information that they need and that we have the data that we need to make sure that this group of children remains a high priority and that we're able to get them the support that they need so that they can really succeed in the future. So I do have one testifier with me today, Marcy Jeffries, and she has a little bit of a PowerPoint to kind of walk through the background and how this proposal came together. I do want to thank Representative Juergens. He's a co-author of the bill, and then we'll stand for questions later on.
And Representative Bennett, I see your hand is up. Do you have a clarifying question now, or should we hold you till the end? You can just.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I will wait until the end because my questions might get answered. So thank you.
Oh, sure. Okay. Thanks, Representative Bennett. Ms. Jeffries, please identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. Thank you. My name is Marcy Jeffries, and also with me today are two people with a lot of hands-on experience and knowledge about this issue who can answer questions you may have as well. I have Craig Radke from the Head Start Association and Brenda Natala with St. Paul Public Schools Early Childhood Special Education, and she's going to be working the slides for me. Just briefly to give you some background on why my interest in this issue. I retired from my position as planning manager for human services in Ramsey County in 2019, following many years of working in a variety of settings, including director of the Child Welfare Studies Center at the University of Minnesota, fiscal policy director for the Children's Defense Fund, and being the fiscal staff for the House of Representatives. I currently serve on the board of directors for the Community Action Partnership for Ramsey and Washington Counties, which runs the Head Start program in those two counties. I'm very pleased that Representative Katiza Watun is bringing this bill before you today. The bill is based on my observations and others that an opportunity exists to increase the well-being and school readiness of some of the most vulnerable children in the state, those who experience foster care. Next slide, please. As Representative Katiza Watun noted, there were more than 6,000 children younger than age 6 in foster care at some point during the year in 2019, and disproportionately they were children of color. And it is important to note that infants and toddlers are the most likely of any age group to be removed from their homes and placed in out-of-home care. This can be as often traumatic for them, and as a result, many, although not all of them, do fall off a healthy developmental track. Fortunately, there are resources in the state to help children such as these get back on track toward life success. Next slide, please. Also, as Representative Cotiz-Watun noted, right now we know very little at a statewide level about the well-being of children in foster care. The information must be pulled together from a variety of sources, primarily at the local level, including from early childhood service providers. What we do know suggests low rates of participation, even though these children are a priority group. For instance, in Ramsey County in 2019, there was an average of 270 zero to five-year-olds in out-of-home care at any one point, and I would say most of them were 0 to 2 years old. Last month, only 15 children were recorded as being in foster care in our CAPRW Head Start attendance report. A similarly small number of children with child protection involvement were referred to the county and served by the St. Paul Public Schools Early Childhood Special Education Program, and only an average of 20 children each year are served there. While these numbers are not perfectly comparable, they do indicate that just a small minority of the possible pool of children are being served in these programs. It is important to note that these early childhood education and care providers, along with Ramsey County staff, made significant efforts in recent years to improve these numbers, but challenges persist. Furthermore, Minnesota is not alone in underutilization of these services by foster children. This is a nationwide shortcoming. Fortunately, I think it will be easier to gather, report, and track this information than it was in the past, thanks to the state's early childhood longitudinal data system. ESLEDS is already beginning to report some information on the early childhood education program participation of kindergartners and families with child protection involvement. There are earlier examples of the benefits of tracking information like this. Legislation was enacted several years ago requiring MDE to report on the participation of young homeless children in early childhood special education. Since then, there has been a substantial increase in the number of homeless children served. Next slide, please. House File 910 does not seek to address the complex reasons that children are removed from their homes, but it does seek to ensure that resources that already exist in our state to address their well-being are more fully utilized. This means effectively connecting them and their caregivers to early childhood resources to support their healthy development while they're in foster care. It also means maintaining those connections once they return to their families of origin or they are adopted. House File 910 requires DHS to work with other state agencies to regularly report on these issues and develop a plan to increase early childhood participation rates. For the plan to be effective, a wide range of voices and perspectives must be included in its development. I know from working on these issues before I retired that developing an effective, workable plan is more complicated than it may seem on the surface. There must be an understanding of the concerns families and their communities have about these programs and issues. The plan must also address state and county administrative issues and specific challenges that county child welfare workers face and providers face. Some potential pathways to increase participation include more support for foster families navigating the early childhood systems, established protocols and processes for child welfare workers that are backed up in the IT system, checklists for courts to ensure judges inquire about the well-being of children in foster care, more training for foster caregivers and staff on early childhood development and clear lines of responsibilities for these issues. But those kind of issues and these kind of solutions should be figured out while in the course of the plan development. Next slide, please. In the process of talking to various groups about their opinions, gathering input, and gathering their support for the bill, here are some of the groups on board so far. As I conclude, I want to make a related observation that's come up already in your discussion this morning. I believe that this committee is at a disadvantage in the budgeting process. While it is well accepted that early investments like the one proposed here will result in savings down the road that exceed their initial cost, those savings cannot be figured into the net cost of the bill or represented in the fiscal note. Nevertheless, as you are clearly aware, these investments are necessary if the state is going to avoid unnecessary and painful costs in the future. So final slide, please. Again, this are Craig and Brenda are here to answer questions. They have real hands-on experience and knowledge. I also included some links to some good national articles that provide background, and that's my contact information. So thank you again, Chair Pinto and Representative Cotiz-Watun.
Thank you, Ms. Jeffries. Representative Katisa Watoon, any other testifiers? I think you have a couple folks available for questions, but.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think anyone else is planning to speak independently, but if there is a question that they can help out with, they're on call.
Okay, let's go to Representative Bennett's question then. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Katisa Watoon, thanks for bringing this forward. I have no problem having this data collected. I think knowledge is good, but I do wonder, or I have a question about what will be done with the data. So I know there are a number of stay-at-home foster parents, and what I'm wondering is if, will a foster child's non-participation in a formal early childhood program be looked on in a negative light, you know, after this data is collected, and could it be a negative mark, I don't know what you would call them, against foster parents or a future negative mark? Just wondering how this is going to be looked upon. I want to make sure that we, you know, embrace our stay-at-home parents as well who are caring for their children at home and not, you know, negatively judge them for that, because that can be also a very rich environment for a child. So just wondering about that.
Representative Katisa Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bennett, for that question. I think it is really important, and we know that many families who are able to have one parent stay home can, you know, give such an enriching childhood start to their kids, and parents are our children's first and best teacher. Outside the legislature right now, I'm actually a stay-at-home parent, so that issue is near and dear to my heart, and I think that it is really important that we consider that. It's certainly not my intention to as the data comes available to us that it would be looked upon negatively if parents are choosing to keep their children at home. And I think just in the conversation, we'd like to get an overarching idea of the participation. So then if it's due to a lack of information or a lack of accessibility, then we get that information to those foster parents, not certainly that they would be required to go forward with participation.
Representative Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Katisa Watoon. That is wonderful. And I'm glad that's kind of on the record that's not the intention. And I don't know if there's a way to add that to the bill or if that's even appropriate, but I think making sure that our intention is not to judge, but rather to collect data and encourage, you know, if participation is desired, get that information out to these foster parents. So appreciate that. I'm just wondering if there are any of the foster parent advocacy groups as part of this Zoom that could comment on this, or are they maybe not on the Zoom? I'm not sure.
Do we Representative Katisa Watoon, or perhaps our committee administrator can remind me if we have somebody who can answer the question from Representative Bennett. We're going to see what my information is. I don't know that we, Representative Katisa Watoon?
I don't think we have anyone online today from Adopt Minnesota or one of the other groups, but we could certainly reach out and try to get some feedback as we go forward.
Yeah, given that the bill's being laid over, I assume Representative Bennett, you probably would appreciate if we could get some input from them on the proposal.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it'd be great to just hear their input. And again, I love this idea, and I just want to make sure that it doesn't turn into anything that would stop a stay-at-home mom or dad, foster parent, from doing that. So thank you so much.
Okay. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Katisa Watoon, for bringing forward this bill. And I just wanted to make a comment that I think it was last year, or it might have been the year before, there is a group of professionals that worked in this field, and they were the ones that were particularly concerned about, they had services to provide, but they were very well aware of the fact that they were not reaching probably one of the most vulnerable groups out there, which is children that are in foster care right now. And one of the stories that they told is that there is like a hero in Hennepin County. It was somebody in Hennepin County that just did everything she could to make sure that just information about these children could be passed on to those that are there to offer services. So this group of people, you know, came forward to me because one of them lived in my district, and they said that this is a real problem. And so I know that this bill isn't going to solve all the problems that we have right now in foster care and to care for these youngest Minnesotans right now, and also in many, many ways, the most vulnerable Minnesotans about us. Doesn't solve all the problems, but I know that even bringing forward this kind of data in a systematic way is a good start for that. So it's one of those very difficult, complicated areas that we need to get right. But what I do know is right now we don't have it right. So thank you for this step forward. And thank you everybody that is supporting this population and caring about this population and caring about our future right now.
We're going to go, Representative Bluton, we're going to go to Representative Juergens' question, then we'll give you a chance to comment at the end. So Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Katiza-Watoon, for bringing this to me so that I could have the opportunity to sign on as a co-author. I appreciate that. And kind of in addition to what Representative Pryor was just saying, that this is a good first step, I agree with that, because oftentimes we don't know what we don't know. And I think that the data that would come from this reporting will give us a better idea of what we don't know and where we need to move forward. My question for you though, Representative, has there been a fiscal note yet? Do we have an idea of what the cost of this report would be?
Representative Katiza-Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Juergens, for that question. A fiscal note has been requested, so we're still waiting on a response for that. We do anticipate that the cost to the state should be minimal, just due to the fact that the data is out there. It just isn't being collected together, and so just this report would kind of bring different pieces, information that's accessible and already being recorded potentially in another report all together, so that we can kind of just really review it and kind of go forward from there. So I think we'll anticipate that comes back around. Well, we did include a blank appropriation in the bill. We do anticipate that cost, if any, would be minimal.
We should know that too when we're considering later. Representative Juergens.
Just to follow up to that, if there, what I would encourage is that we also keep in mind if there are increased costs from at the county levels for gathering this data, that we keep that in mind too. We don't like unfunded mandates. So if we're going to require something more from the counties, we should be making sure that we keep them whole in that way. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Juergens. Representative Katiza-Watoon, any comment on that, first of all?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that is a really good point. And I know we all know that our amazing people who work as social workers across the state and at the county level are working tirelessly to support this population of children, and they're recording the data ongoing. So I think that it's certainly not my intention to add another unfunded mandate at the county level or a really additional paperwork burden. I think that if the data is already being captured, hopefully we're able to redirect that in the most efficient way possible and kind of pull it into this report. So then going forward, everything is there for us. But I appreciate that feedback, Representative Juergens.
And we should probably pivot to our last bill. Representative Katiza-Watoon, then any final brief comment?
I think this is a good bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the consideration.
Thank you, Representative Katiza-Watoon, and thank you to Ms. Jeffries and to folks who brought this bill together. Really appreciate it. So with that, it's a House file. Make sure I get the correct bill number. Pardon me, hold on. 910 is being laid over for possible inclusion in a budget proposal. And thank you, Representative Katiza-Watoon. Representative Wasilek, we have House file 668. Would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move House File 668 before the committee, and I believe it's being laid over. Is that correct?
My plan, Representative Wasilek, is to lay the bill over as well for possible inclusion in our budget bill. And the bill is now before the committee, pursuant to your motion. And so, Representative Wasilek, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 668 is an attempt to try and make childcare more accessible for children with disabilities across the state. As members of the committee know all too well, there is a serious shortage of affordable childcare in our state. And the shortage acutely affects families who have children with disabilities and complex medical needs. We know that without childcare, parents of children with disabilities often leave the workforce, and that this has a larger impact, particularly on mothers of children who often are doing that caregiving at home. We know that childcare providers want to serve children with disabilities, but they don't always have the resources that they need or the training or the knowledge that they need to do that. So this is an attempt to try and get the resources and knowledge to childcare providers so that they can provide those children with care. So House File 668 establishes a two-year pilot project that will provide grants to counties and tribes to work together to determine what sort of supports childcare providers need in order to serve children with disabilities in inclusive settings. And the goal is for this pilot to occur in a county in the metro area, as well as in greater Minnesota, to as we understand that there are different needs and resources available in different counties across the state. I just want to share an example of, I work in a school-based child care program, and one of the things that we have in our schools, a lot of our schools, is that we have more resources than a lot of, for example, family child care or center child care, center-based child care might have. So we had a student who had some sensory issues and needed some extra support from physical therapists and occupational therapists and some other supports that, because we had the resources and we had the folks, the knowledgeable staff available in our school setting, that we were able to get those resources and those services for that student and really help them thrive and do really well in our program. And it was a big change that we saw, as that student was able to get access to those services and really do well in our program. So I think it speaks to how we can do it, and we know that we can do it. It's just a matter of having those supports there for child care providers to do it. So with that, I wanna turn it over to a couple of folks who are going to be testifying in support of the bill today. And I think first up, we have Maren Halden.
Ms. Halden, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair Pinto and members. My name is Maren Halden, and I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, which includes the Minnesota Disability Law Center. I'm here in my professional capacity. This is my job, but I'm also here in my personal capacity as a parent. My son August is 4, and he has cerebral palsy, which we learned when he was 2, after pretty apparent developmental delays for a long time before that. After some really intensive physical therapy and speech therapy, he started to walk when he was 3, and now he uses at least 200 sign language as his main way of communicating. He's also a really great big brother to our 2-year-old son. We started him at the child care center near our house when he was 6 months old, and he's gone there ever since, and he loves it. They've found ways to accommodate him really well, and his teachers work hard to meet his needs. One teacher is even learning sign languages and always teaching him and us new words. For August, being part of classes with typical peers has been just fantastic. He experiences belonging and being part of a community. When we ask him what he did at school each day, he signs like 4 different things, but the first one is always friends. The second one is always nap, but the first one is friends. We get pictures from school, and I can share my screen and show a couple of them, of him playing with friends, of him, there he is in his walker in the playground. Here he is signing blue because the car is blue. Here he is playing Legos. This was just from yesterday. Here they are playing a dancing game where they were supposed to walk like a duck, which thanks to all the physical therapy, he can do just the same way his peers are doing. He knows his colors, his shapes, he can identify some letters, and his school district IEP team recently said that it's obvious he belongs in a general education classroom when it's time for him to go to school, which I don't think would be a given if he hadn't been in this inclusive childcare setting. So August certainly benefits from being at school with his brother and his peers, but his peers benefit from him being there too. About a year ago before the pandemic, a dad stopped me at Target once to say like how grateful he was that his 3 sons get to go to school with August, because August shows them that there are just so many different ways a person can be in the world. I'm so grateful every day for the experience our family is having with childcare, but I know that families who have kids with disabilities often don't have a positive experience like ours. The Disability Law Center, I handled cases all the time where kids were either asked to leave childcare provider settings or they weren't accepted into them in the first place because of the child's disability, because the provider just wasn't able to meet their needs. Childcare providers want to serve kids who have disabilities, but they need support. And the need for this has only gotten greater during the pandemic. As you all know, childcare providers are under even greater stress, and families have even fewer options for childcare. I am, like, every day my husband leaves in the car with the kids for daycare, I am so grateful, because honestly, if we didn't have childcare in August, they weren't able to meet August's needs, I really worry I wouldn't be able to continue working. So this proposal would allow providers and counties to work together to both figure out what supports childcare providers need to serve a kid with a disability who they otherwise wouldn't be able to serve, and the best way to get those supports to childcare providers. Thank you so much to Representative Wasilik for your leadership on this important bill. And thank you all for the conversations that we've had and for listening. I really hope you'll support this important opportunity to create more opportunities for kids who have disabilities in childcare settings.
Thank you, Ms. Holden. And I believe Ms. Christensen is up, and if you can identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you so much, Chairman Pindell and committee members. My name is Maren Christensen Hofer, and I am the parent of an autistic child, and I'm speaking to you today on behalf of the Multicultural Autism Action to share some of the perspectives of a parent. And I'm sad to say that we didn't have the great experience that Maren Holden had. We were one of those families that really struggled. And if I may, I'd like to tell you a little bit about my child. He is a kiddo who has no developmental disabilities or speech delays, but he has a very heightened fight or flight response and a lot of challenges with sensory processing. He does best in an environment that's very calm and quiet and not too overwhelming, which, as I'm sure you're all aware very well, is kind of hard to come by in a childcare setting. So we were overjoyed when we found a small private provider that seemed like it was a good fit for him, and he really did well there. While he was there, he received his autism diagnosis, and immediately upon receipt of that diagnosis, the center told us that they were not able to meet his needs. And to be clear, I don't want to ascribe any ill will on the part of the center, but I think they were just feeling ill-prepared to support a child with autism, and they really were unaware of what supports could be provided and what sensory processing different were. That has just been never part of their training or part of their experience. So they decided that they were not able to support him, and we had to leave. And you can imagine that was pretty devastating for us. We looked for other options, and we weren't able to find anything that would work for him. And that is one of many reasons that I left a professional career in international business development in the medical industry. And I know that I'm not alone. I'm one of many, many families that have had that experience. And in fact, the National Survey of Children's Health showed that compared to parents of non-disabled children, parents of children with disabilities are 3 times more likely to experience job disruptions because of issues with childcare, and that often multiplies to include more financial strain, more health challenges, more stress, more reliance on informal networks. And I really want to make clear that this isn't just a childcare issue. It's not just a family issue. It's an economic issue. And I think that's become even more abundantly clear as a result of the pandemic. And while I certainly understand that some kids are more expensive to care for than others, accessible buildings cost money, training costs money. But I do believe that it costs significantly less to provide that support and that assistance than to have a large number of parents drop out of the workforce because they can't find that inclusive childcare. And my colleague Maren Holden talked a little bit about the importance of inclusion and how important that was for her son. It's very, very clear that inclusive childcare produces better outcomes for the child with a disability. But I want to emphasize that it really plays a great role for the other children in the childcare settings to be surrounded by kids with disabilities, because it gives them an opportunity to learn the value of people with all sorts of abilities from a very early age. We know how important that inclusion is. And the message that disability is not something to be ashamed of or to be isolated or to be othered. And we've made a lot of progress in that area over the past years, but inclusive childcare is one area where we still have a long way to go. And we feel that this bill is gonna help us take a step in the right direction. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Representative Wasilik, are we ready for questions or anything, anybody else to present? No?
No, no other testifiers that I'm aware of. I'm open to questions if members have them.
Members, any questions for Representative Wasilewicz or for either of these testifiers? Representative Juergens.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the two Marins, thank you both for being here to testify today. And thank you for the recent conversation that we had. And Ms. Holden, I know we said this in our conversation, but I wanted to say it publicly. And also, you had mentioned this in your testimony, but this program is not only helpful to families like yours and to children like August, but the conversation that you relayed about the father at Target, who said that how he appreciates his sons or his children knowing someone like August. And to me, that's the real value of this type of a program. Yes, it's a value to you and your kids and your family, but to the other kids who can see that August is a kid just like me, he might just be a little bit different. And to learn that at such a young age, I think it's really very valuable. And so I'm a big fan of this program for those reasons. And as I was sitting here, I sent an email in to have my name added as a co-author on this bill. But so thank you both for being here today.
Thank you, Representative Juergens. Representative Wasilewicz, you've gained a co-author. So good stuff. Anybody else? Let's see. So I'll give just a minute here in case there are. So Representative Wasilewicz, it looks like you get the final word, ready for your final word on the bill. So please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you to the testifiers here today. We might have enough to make a Marin caucus at this point. I'm not sure, but always appreciate hearing directly from folks who are directly impacted by this. I think they're the best sort of folks to speak to the need for this. And we know that, child care providers want to provide child care for kids with disabilities. It's just they don't always have the resources to do that. So this is a good way to start really putting resources into those providers and figuring out what works best so we can hopefully, get some good information, share it with other providers, and figure out how to make our childcare settings more inclusive. So thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to present the bill, and looking forward to continuing to work to improve access for students with disabilities.
Thank you, Representative Wasilewicz, and thank you to the two testifiers, Ms. Holden and Ms. Christensen. Really appreciate you sharing your experience in support of this bill. So with that, House File 668 is laid over for possible inclusion in a early childhood budget bill. And we have one bit of business before we conclude, which is this clerk has informed me that there may have been an error in the reporting of the vote on House File 1024. And so Ms. Chambers, if you can just clarify that, and if that is correct, then provide the correct vote total.
Yes, Chair Pinto, the correct vote total was 10 yeas and 3 nays.
Okay, and that was the vote on House File 1024, is that correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay, good, thank you. And then members, the plan for next week, just to give you a bit of a heads up, is that on Tuesday we'll be hearing the proposal for paid family and medical leave, and also for support for family, friend, and neighbor care. And so discussing that, and then on Thursday, hearing a series of proposals for to support providers. And so we'll be looking at that. As always, please don't hesitate to reach out to me and continue our conversations. Thank you so much for the rich conversation today. And with that, our meeting is adjourned. Thanks so much.